outside phone lines in these cottages? He chuckled. Sure do. Got electricity, too. I wanted to tell him we'd just come from a luxury resort without television or phone service, but he wouldn't believe that. He said, Pond House has cable TV and VCR, and you got internet hookup. No kidding. Hey, do you have a laptop I could borrow or rent? Got one you can use for free if you get it back to me by 6:30. That's when the wife goes on eBay to check her auction. That woman buys junk, then she sells it back on eBay. She says she's making money, but I don't think so. If I wasn't trying to keep a low profile, I'd tell him that she was probably fucking the UPS guy. But I just smiled. Anyway, I paid cash for the room, which Ned appreciated, and he didn't seem to need any ID or security deposit. He handed me his laptop, worth about $1,000. I thought about asking him for a six-pack of beer while I was at it, but I didn't want to impose on his hospitality. Ned gave us a key to the cottage, some basic house rules, and directions to Pond House. Just follow your nose. That would have put me in his kitchen, but I think he meant get in the car first. Kate and I went to the car, and she said to me, "Do you see how nice and trusting people are here?" I seem to be missing my wallet. She ignored that and continued, "This is like where I was raised in Minnesota." Well, they did a good job there. Let's discuss relocation later. I followed my nose for 100 yards, and we came to a little shingled cottage on a pond. Kate took a briefcase, and we entered. It was a decent enough place, with a combination sitting room, bedroom, and kitchen decorated in what looked like eclectic eBay. Out back was an enclosed porch that overlooked the pond. Hopefully, there was an indoor bathroom somewhere. Kate was inspecting the kitchen, and I asked her, "What's in the fridge?" She opened the door. "A light bulb." "Call room service." She again ignored me and found the bathroom. I picked up the phone on the writing desk and called Dick Kearns, collect. He accepted the charges and asked me, "Why am I paying for this call? I'm in jail, and I already used my free call to call my bookie." "Where are you? Who's Wilma on my caller ID?" "Ned's wife." "How'd you make out?" "With what?" "Oh, Pushkin, Russian writer, dead. No further information." Dick apparently felt the need to jerk me around in lieu of billing me. I said, "Come on, Dick. This is important. First, I'm required to ask you, what is your clearance?" 5 feet 11 inches. "Unfortunately, Detective Corey, most of this stuff is not available to people under 6 feet, but I'll just write here that you've applied for a 6-foot clearance." The old joke out of the way, Dick said, "Okay, ready to copy?" "Hold on." Kate had come out of the bathroom and pulled up a kitchen chair near the desk. I said to Dick, "I'm putting us on speaker." I hit the speaker button, hung up, and said, "Say hello to Kate." "Hi, Kate." "Hi, Dick. I'm glad you're there to keep this guy out of trouble." "I'm trying." "Did I ever tell you about the time—" "Dick," I interrupted, "we're on a tight schedule." "Yeah, me too. Okay, ready?" Kate got a notebook, and I took the pad and pencil from the desk and said, "Shoot." "All right. Putyov, Mikhail. Born in Kursk, Russia. Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, 18 May 1941. Father deceased, 1943. Red Army captain. Killed in action. Mother deceased. No further info. Subject attended..." I can't pronounce these fucking Russian words. "Spell them." "Right." He filled us in on Mikhail Putyov's education, and my eyes were glazing over until he said, "He graduated from Leningrad Polytechnic Institute with an advanced degree in nuclear physics. And later, he was associated with the..." "What the hell? Kurchatov?" "Yeah, Kurchatov Institute in Moscow. This says it's a major Soviet nuclear facility, and this guy did research there. I didn't comment, but Kate and I exchanged glances. Dick asked, "Is that what you're looking for?" "What else?" "Well, then he worked in a borscht factory, dropping little potatoes in the soup." "Dick, he worked on the Soviet nuclear weapons program someplace in Siberia. He spelled the name of some town or installation. This stuff seems to be classified, and from 1979 to the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, there's not much info."
"Okay. How reliable is this information?"
"Some of it I got directly from the FBI. Putyov is on their watch list. Most of it I got from Putyov's own CV, which is posted on the website where he works."
"Where is that?"
"Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He's a full professor there."
"What's he teach?"
"Not Russian history."
"Right.
I also got some stuff on him online from academic journals. He's well respected."
"For what?"
"Nuclear shit. I don't know. You want me to read this stuff?"
"I'll check it out later. What else?"
"Well, I lucked out with the FBI field office in Boston. I found a guy there who I knew, and he was willing to talk off the record. He told me that Putyov was brought here in 1995 as part of our post-Soviet resettling program to neutralize some of this free-floating nuke talent before these guys sold out to the highest bidder. He was set up in this teaching job at MIT as part of the resettling program."
"They should have just shot him."
Dick chuckled and said, "That would have been cheaper. They bought him an apartment in Cambridge, and he still draws a couple of bucks from Uncle Sam. In fact, I did a quick credit check on him, and he comes up AAA. No money or credit problems, which, as we know, eliminates half the motives for half the illegal shit that goes on in the world."
"Right. It was the other half that worried me. The kind of motive for unlawful activities that an oil billionaire might find irresistible. Like power, glory, revenge."
Kate asked, "Why is he on the FBI watch list?" "This guy in Boston told me it was standard procedure for a person like that. The Bureau doesn't have any negatives on him. But they require him to notify them when he leaves the area because, as the guy I spoke to said, Putyov is a walking brain full of things that he shouldn't be sharing with any country that's got an illegal nuke program in the works."
I inquired, "Did Putyov notify the Boston office that he was leaving town?"
"I don't know, and I didn't ask. I was lucky enough to get this guy to talk to me off the record. But my questions were confined to background stuff."
Kate asked, "Wife? Kids?"
"Two grown sons, also brought here as part of the resettling package. Nothing on them. Wife, Svetlana, doesn't speak much English."
Kate asked, "You spoke to her?"
"Yeah, I called the apartment. But before that, I called his office at MIT. His secretary, a Ms. Crabtree, said he emailed her over the weekend, Saturday, and wrote that he wouldn't be back until Tuesday, today. But he's not there yet, and no one has heard from him." He added, "I guess he's up there where you are, right?"
"We don't know." Odd, I thought, that he'd canceled his 12:45 flight to Boston sometime last night, but hadn't yet contacted his office or the airline to rebook on the next flight to Boston, which I recalled would be 9:55 tomorrow morning, and he wasn't driving back to Boston in his rental car because it had been returned.
Kate asked, "Did his secretary sound concerned?" "I couldn't tell. She was professional, and I had no reason to push her. So I call Svetlana, and she says to me, 'He not home.' So I ask, 'When he be home?' And she says, 'Tuesday.' And I say, 'Today is Tuesday.' And she says, 'Cool beak,' and hangs up."
"Cool beak?"
"Yeah, that's Russian for call back. So I called back about 20 minutes ago and said, 'I need to reach McHale. He won $1 million in the Reader's Digest sweepstakes,
and he needs the claim as prize money. And she said, Mooney? Wat Mooney? Anyway, I don't think he's home, or she'd have put him on to claim his money. So, is this guy missing? Maybe. Anything else? No. That's the basic free introductory offer. Did you get a cell phone number for this guy? I asked Svetlana and his secretary. They weren't giving it out, but I'll bet they called it a few times. Right. How about the phone company? Or the FBI office in Boston? I'll try the phone company, but I'm not calling my FBI source back. I went as far as I could with him, and he was cooperative, but then he got nosy. We've got to leave that alone unless you want to stir up some shit. Okay, leave that alone. Kate, why am I doing this? When I worked for the ATTF, they had their own computers, phones, and files. She looked at me, then said to Dick, Your friend is pursuing his own theory about something. Right. Did you tell him he needs to be a team player? I mentioned that a few times. By now, I was rolling my eyes. Dick said, Well, when John gets fired, I need some help here. Kate replied, I think he'll be on the federal do-not-hire list forever. Okay, I interrupted. Let's get back to business. Dick, is there anything else you can think of that might be important or relevant? Relevant to what? Good question. And before I could think of an answer, Dick asked, What's with the nuke stuff? I don't think that's relevant to the homicide investigation. Why would an MIT professor be mixed up with a murder? I thought he might be Russian mafia, but it doesn't sound like it. Okay, So, did the Arabs snatch this guy? I don't think so. I'll take Putyov's home and work numbers. He gave them to us and said, Okay, guys, the ball is in your court. Good luck with locating Putyov, and I hope you find the son of a bitch who killed Harry Muller. We will. Kate said, Thanks, Dick. Watch yourselves. We hung up, and Kate looked at me. Nuclear physicist. Right. What's he doing at the Custer Hill Club? Fixing the microwave oven. John, we need to fly to New York today and have Walsh assemble the appropriate people. Hold on. You're overreacting. We don't have any startling information other than a nuclear physicist happened to be a guest at the Custer Hill Club. We have Mad, Nuke, Elf, and... Geez, I hope they found that by now. What if they haven't? Then they're stupid. John, we can't admit to having evidence that we've hidden. Well, that we just forgot to mention. We... She rose from her chair and said, You didn't report it. We have committed a felony. I'm an accessory. I also stood. Don't you think I'm gonna cover for you? I don't need you to cover for me. We need to report everything we have, including Putyov. Now. For all we know, the FBI knows everything we know, and they're not sharing it with us. So why should we share it with them? That's our job. Right. And we will share it. But not now. Think of what we're doing as a supplemental investigation. No. We're engaged in an unauthorized investigation. Wrong. Walsh authorized us. Liam Griffith? Fuck him. For all I know, he's here to bring us a week's worth of clean underwear. You know why he's here. No, I don't. And neither do you. She moved closer to me. John, what's your agenda? As always, truth and justice. I added, duty, honor, country. Bullshit. Well, the real answer is we need to save our asses. We're in trouble. And the only way out of that trouble is to bring this case further along toward... And don't forget your ego. This is John Corey, NYPD, trying to prove that he's smarter than the whole FBI. I don't need to prove that. It's an established fact. I'm going back to New York. Are you coming with me? No. I need to find Harry's killer. She sat on the bed, sorta staring at the floor. Clearly, she was upset. I stood there for a full minute, then said, "Kate." I put my hand on her shoulder. "Trust me." She didn't reply for a while, then muttered, almost to herself, "Why can't we just return to New York and tell Tom everything we know, and try to salvage our careers?" "Because," I replied, "we're past the point of no return. There is no turning back." I added, "Sorry." She sat there a bit longer, then stood.
"All right, what's next?"
ELF. Chapter 36. Kate seemed to have calmed down a little and resigned herself to the fact that the idiot who got her into this mess was probably the only idiot who could get her out of it. I was feeling a little pressured by that, but I knew if I stayed focused and solved this case, Harry's murder and the Maddox mystery, then our career problems and personal problems would disappear. And while we were at it, maybe we could also save the planet. As Kate herself said, "Nothing succeeds like success." The opposite of that was, well, disgrace, humiliation, dismissal, the unemployment line, and some sort of nuclear surprise. But why be negative? To make Kate feel part of the solution, I said to her, "Okay, I'll take your advice, and we'll call John Nassif." Kate and I sat at the writing desk and took out our notepads. I'd rather have used Ned's laptop, but I was pretty certain that John Nassif, who was a technical support guy, was out of the ATTF loop anyway. She dialed out, using her personal calling card that would not show Wilma's number on a caller ID, then identified herself to the ATTF operator and asked for Commander Nassif. She put the phone on speaker, and as the call was routed, she said to me, "John Nassif is an active-duty naval commander, so you may want to initially address him by his rank." She added, "He's an officer and a gentleman, so watch your language. And you be careful how you phrase the questions." She replied, "I think I know how to do this. But why don't you take the lead as you usually do?" "Yes, ma'am." Navy Commander John Nassif came on the line. "Hi, Kate. How can I help you?"
"Hi, John. My husband John, who works for me, and I need some information about extremely low-frequency radio waves. Can you help with that?"
"I think so." He paused, then said, "Can I ask what this is about?" I chimed in, "Good afternoon, Commander. This is Detective Corey, who works for Special Agent Mayfield."
"Just call me John."
"Same to you. To answer your question, unfortunately, this is a sensitive matter, and we're only at liberty to say it's urgent."
"I understand. What would you like to know?"
I asked, "Can ELF waves fry an egg?" Kate looked pissed, but Commander John replied, "I don't think so." John Nassif sounded like the starched Navy guy that he probably was, so I followed up with, "Just kidding. Can you give us some background on ELF waves? And please don't be too technical. I can't even program the buttons on my car radio." I got him to chuckle, and he replied, "All right. It's sort of a technical subject, but I'll try to speak English. First, I am not an expert on ELF signals, but I can certainly give you some basic background." "We're all ears." I opened my notepad and picked up my pencil. "Well, to begin, I'm pulling up some of this on my computer. Okay. ELF waves are transmitted at extremely low frequencies." He chuckled to himself and said, "That's why they're called. Anyway, these are extremely long waves. So say you're transmitting at 82 hertz, or 0.000082 megahertz. That's equal to a wavelength of 3,658,535.5 meters, or 3,658.5 kilometers. I dropped my pencil and said, "Hold on, John, hold on. We don't want to send a message on our ELF transmitter. Who uses this wavelength? And what's it used for? He replied, It's only used by the military, specifically the Navy. It's used to contact nuclear submarines operating at very low depths. Kate and I looked at each other. I wanted to ask him if he knew Fred, but instead I inquired, Can these ELF waves be monitored?
Sure, if you have the right equipment. But you might wait a long time to hear an ELF transmission.
Why?
They have very limited use, and anything you heard would be encrypted.
Okay, take us through this. Who, what, where, when, how, and why?
I don't think anything I'm going to say is classified, but I need to ask you if you're on a secure line. Typical military commo guy. I thought maybe Ned was listening to pass the time of day, but he didn't look like a spy, and Wilma was probably watching the home shopping network. I said to Commander Nassif, We're on a regular landline, and it's a one-time use for me at a resort up in the Adirondacks. We weren't actually in the Adirondack Mountains any longer, but that's where Walsh and Griffith needed to think we were if this conversation got back to them. I added, a resort called The Point. The chef is French, but I'm sure he's not listening in. All right. As I said, most of this is not classified. So let me explain the practical application of ELF technology. As you know, we have nuclear subs operating at very low depths for extended periods of time, months sometimes, and most of these subs operate in their regular patrol areas near, well, this is a little sensitive, but I'll say near underwater hydroacoustic stations where they can be in touch with naval operations through normal radio channels. But some of these subs can be out in no man's land. Too far from these underwater stations. So, in an emergency situation, naval operations in Pearl Harbor for the Pacific Fleet or Norfolk for the Atlantic Fleet need to get in touch with these nuclear submarines that are not near the surface or near an underwater relay station. Follow so far? I looked at Kate, who nodded, and I said, Sure, go on. Well, he continued, for instance... Normally used VLF waves, very low frequency, won't penetrate deep into the ocean depths, especially if the water is very saline. Salty. I got salty. Good. But ELF waves can travel all the way around the world regardless of atmospheric conditions, and they can penetrate anything, including mountains, oceans, and polar ice caps. They can reach a deeply submerged submarine any time, any place. In fact, if it weren't for the existence of ELF waves, we'd have no communication with some of these vessels in our nuclear submarine fleet. And that could lead to a major problem if the balloon went up.
What balloon?
The balloon. That's slang for atomic war.
Right.
I like balloon better. Again, Kate and I looked at each other, trying to comprehend this. I didn't know how she was feeling, but thinking of Bane Maddox, I was a little worried. Commander Nassif made a funny doomsday joke by saying, If it wasn't for ELF, we couldn't have a good all-out atomic war.
Well, thank God for ELF.
He chuckled. That's an old Navy commo joke.
That's a real knee-slapper.
Got any more?
Well, gee, it's been a long time since the Cold War, but...
I interrupted. So that's the only way, the only reason anyone would use an ELF radio to talk to a submarine. He replied, Well, it's not actually a voice radio. It's more of a signal transmitter, like a telegraph, to send encrypted letter code messages.
And only to a submarine?
Right. A deeply submerged submarine. ELF waves are very long, and therefore the transmissions are very slow. But they can penetrate anything. Thus, their only practical use is to contact submerged submarines that can't be contacted by normal means.
Right. Can ELF waves screw up my cell phone?
He chuckled again. No, these waves are so far off the chart, they wouldn't interfere with any other radio waves, microwaves, or anything we currently use on a day-to-day basis. Kate said to him, "So, these ELF transmissions are letter codes?" "Correct." "And they can only be picked up by submarines?" "Well, they can be picked up by anyone with an ELF receiver. But unless you know the code, which changes often, it would be meaningless. All you'd hear would be transmitted pulses, which are the letters in encrypted form. From what I understand, a three-letter code is the most common." Kate asked, "And that tells the people on the sub everything they need to know?" "Usually it just tells them that they need to establish normal radio communication." He explained, "An ELF transmission is called a bell ringer. It's to alert a submarine commander that a situation is developing and he needs to do something to get in touch. But sometimes the three-letter code is self-explanatory. For instance, it could mean surface or proceed to location A, which is a pre-designated grid coordinate. Follow?" Kate replied, "I think so." "You can't use ELF for long, chatty messages. It can take half an hour for the signal to reach the sub. And I should point out that the submarine can't send an ELF signal or message. It can only receive one." I said, "Like, don't call us, we'll call you." "Correct." Kate asked, "Why can't a sub send an ELF message?" "The transmitter and antenna need to be on land. I can explain that later. But meanwhile, if a submarine needs to reply to this one-way message, or if the sub commander needs more data, then the sub would need to get near an underwater hydroacoustic station, if there's time, or would need to get near the surface and send up a communication buoy to reply, or get more information via VLF, or these days via satellite or other means." I inquired, "What do you mean, if there's time?" "Well, for instance, if the other side has already launched ICBMs against us, then there's no time to establish normal radio communication. Because by the time the sub receives an ELF signal, which, as I said, can take 30 minutes, all forms of communication in the U.S. have already been vaporized, and the atomic war is all but over." He explained, "If that's what's happening on the surface, then the submarines receive the last and only ELF message they will ever get, a three-letter code that means, well, fire away." Kate looked a bit worried, but Commander Nassif had good news. ELF waves are not affected by thermonuclear explosions. I said, "Thank God for that. But let me ask you, what if the guy sending the atomic launch code sends the wrong letters? Like, he means to type in XYZ, which means lunch break, but he screws up and types in XYV, which means launch your nukes." Commander Nassif replied with a little amusement in his voice, "That can't happen." "Why not? Look at the emails you get." "I mean," he explained patiently, "there are safeguards, and all orders to launch need to be verified." "By who?" "By the time the sub gets the order a half hour after it's sent, as you just said, there's no one left to verify anything." "This is true. But rest assured, that can't happen." "Why not? I mean, you're talking about three measly letters. Like those monkeys typing King Lear. For your information, a three-letter code will yield 17,576 possible letter combinations in the English language alphabet. The Russian alphabet, with 33 letters, will yield 35,937 different codes." He explained, 33 × 33 × 33 = 35,937. "So, what are the chances that a naval radio operator could mistakenly send the code to the submarine fleet to launch their missiles at their pre-designated targets?" Considering the fact that if something could go wrong, it would, I thought the chances seemed pretty good. I said,
maybe we should use the Russian alphabet. You know? More letters. Less chance of starting a nuclear war by accident. He found that funny and said to me, "Actually, if you want to know more than you need to know, whoever transmits the message needs to send it as a repeating, error-correcting code, followed by another three-letter verification code. No one can screw that up by accident." I asked the obvious and more pertinent question, how about on purpose? Like some nut who wants to start an atomic war. He thought about that and replied, "As I said, the codes change frequently. But if someone had the code, I can't imagine that any unauthorized person could get the initiating codes and the verification codes, plus getting the current encrypting protocols. Also, the computer encryption software is sophisticated beyond anything you can imagine." He added, "You shouldn't worry about things like that." I thought of Bain Maddox and wanted to say to Commander Nassif, "You should." Kate asked, "And there is no other possible application for this means of communication? I mean, no other use for ELF waves other than military?" "Well, that was true. But I've heard that since the end of the Cold War, the Russian ELF transmitter has been used for geophysical research. Swords into plowshares." He explained, "The ELF waves can penetrate deep into the Earth's crust and can therefore be used for electromagnetic sounding and monitoring. For instance, seismic research, earthquake predictions, and things of that sort. But I don't know much about that." Kate said, "So theoretically, someone outside the military could send an ELF transmission, like scientists." "Theoretically. But there are only three ELF transmitters in the whole world, and they're all owned by the military." He added, "We have two, they have the other." Kate thought about that, then asked, "I see. But theoretically, is this top secret, or is it unlawful to build such a transmitter?" "I don't know about unlawful. And there's nothing top secret about the technology or the physics behind it. The actual problem is that an ELF transmitting station can be expensive to build, and it has no practical application outside of contacting submarines or, recently, in limited geophysical research." I didn't think that Bain Maddox was interested in geophysical research, but he might be, so I asked, "Can these ELF waves detect oil deposits?" "I would think so." "So, geologists could use them to find oil?" "Theoretically, but ELF stations can only be built in a few places in the world." Kate inquired, "Why is that?" "Well, now that we're talking about the actual transmitter itself, let me explain that. You asked why a submarine can't send an ELF message. One reason is that an ELF transmitter can only be located on land in an area that has very low ground conductivity. And there are only a few places on the planet where this geological condition exists." I asked, "Of course, and where is that?" "Well, one is where the Russian transmitter, called Zevs, is located, northwest of Murmansk, up near the Arctic Circle. Another place where these necessary conditions exist is here in the U.S. Our two transmitters are the Wisconsin Transmitter Facility, WTF, and the Michigan Transmitter Facility, MTF. And they both share the same geological formation called the Laurentian Shield." "And that's it?" "Well, that's it for existing ELF transmitters. But the Brits almost built one during the Cold War for the Royal Navy at a suitable location called Glengarry Forest in Scotland. But for a variety of political and practical reasons, the idea was scrapped." Neither Kate nor I said anything for a while. Then Kate recapped, "So there are only three ELF transmitters in the entire world." Commander Nassif made a little joke and replied, "Last time I counted." "Well," I thought, "count again, Commander." Kate and I glanced at each other, but neither of us asked the obvious question about other suitable and perhaps close by locations. We knew we needed to finesse that question so as not to have Commander Nassif sitting around a coffee bar telling people that Corey and Mayfield were asking about ELF transmitters in the Adirondack Mountains. John Nassif took the silence to mean we were done taking up his time and asked, "Was that helpful?" Kate replied,
"Very. Thank you. One more question. I'm not clear on something. You are saying it's possible for a private individual to build an ELF transmitter?"
John Nassif was probably thinking about lunch, but answered, "Sure. Someone can build one in his basement or garage. It's actually fairly basic technology, and some of the components are probably off-the-shelf items. And what's not readily available can be built or bought for the right money. The real problem is the location of the antenna and the size of the antenna."
"Why is that a problem?"
"Because this is not a standard vertical antenna. An ELF antenna is actually a long cable, or cables. These cables are strung on telephone-type poles, usually in a big circle, and they run for miles." That sounded like something I'd seen recently. I asked, "Why is that difficult? Or expensive?" "Well, it's expensive," Nassif replied, "if the government does it." He got off a good laugh, then continued, "As I said, it's all about geology and geography. First, you need to find a location where the rock formation is suitable. Then you need to acquire a sufficiently large area of that land."
"Then what?"
"Well, then you string your cables, which are actually the feed for your antenna. These cables may have to run for hundreds of miles, in a circle to save space. Or if the geological conditions are perfect, you could get away with, say, 50 miles or less." Kate said,
"I'm not quite following the geological angle."
"Oh, well, let me look this up."
"Okay.
A necessary ground condition to build an ELF antenna is an area where there are only a few meters of sand, or moraine gravel. Beneath that, you need a rock base of igneous granite, or metamorphic..."
What the hell is this?
He spelled G-N-E-I-S-S. I said, "I hope that's not the code to launch." He chuckled. "I guess it's a type of rock. Let's see. Areas of very old Precambrian mountain chains, such as the Laurentian Shield, where our ELF installations are located. The Kola Peninsula in Russia, where they have their ELF installation. This place in Scotland, where the Brits decided not to build an ELF station. A place near the Baltic Sea. Well, you get the picture." I didn't hear him say the Adirondack Mountains, and I was really listening closely. He continued, "So if someone wants to build an ELF station, he goes to one of these areas, buys enough land, then sinks telephone poles in the bedrock and strings antenna wire between them, in a circle. The better the geological conditions, the shorter the wire has to be to provide the same transmitting power. Then the antenna wire is connected to a thick copper grounding cable, which runs down one or more of the telephone poles into a deep borehole in the low conductivity rock. Then a powerful electrical generator, and this is a big expense, feeds the antenna cables, and the current runs around the antenna wire, then goes down the copper grounding cables into the rock. And then the earth itself becomes the actual antenna. Follow?" I replied, "Absolutely." I don't think he believed me and said, "This is a little technical for me too. But it seems that if you have enough electrical generating capacity, thousands of kilowatts, and once you get the antenna right, the actual radio transmitter is not that difficult to build, and you can transmit ELF wave signals to your heart's content." He added, "Unfortunately, no one is listening." I reminded him, "The submarines are listening." Only if they happen to be on the frequency that you're transmitting. The Russians are transmitting on 82 hertz, and we are transmitting on 76 hertz. And even if the submarines are hearing something on the appropriate frequency, their ELF receiver would probably reject the signal. Why? Because, as I said, military signals are computer encrypted. Encrypted when transmitted and decrypted at the receiving end. Otherwise, he explained, any nut, as you seem to be suggesting, could theoretically play havoc with the Russian and American nuclear submarine fleets. You know, like start World War III. I knew exactly what he meant without the explicit example. Kate was standing now.
Has anyone ever tried something like that? She asked.
Commander Nassif was silent on that subject, so I asked the same question. He came back with a question of his own. What are you guys on to? I knew that was coming, and I didn't want him sending a 3-letter code to the Pentagon that meant check out Corey and Mayfield. I said to him, well, as you may know, we're in the Mideast section. That's all I can say. He thought about that, then responded, well, these people may have, or may be able to acquire this technology, but I don't think there's a suitable geological area in any of those countries. That's good news, I said. But this really wasn't about our Mideast friends. I asked him once again, has anyone, in the past, ever tried to send a bogus signal to our submarine fleet? I've heard a rumor to that effect. When? How? What happened? Well, if you can believe this rumor, about 15 years ago, our nuclear sub-fleet was receiving encoded ELF messages, but the onboard submarine computers weren't able to verify the legitimacy of the encoded messages, so they were rejected. He continued, and when the sub-commanders contacted naval operations in Pearl Harbor and Norfolk by other means, they were informed that no such messages had been sent by them via Wisconsin. Michigan hadn't been built yet. He stayed quiet for a few seconds, then added, it appeared that some entity was sending bogus messages, but the safeguards worked, and none of the subs took action based on those messages. I asked, what action? What did the messages say? Launch. The room was quiet for a while. Then Kate asked, could it have been the Russians sending those messages? No. First, the Russians didn't even have ELF transmitting capabilities until about 1990. And even if they did, there was no logical reason for them to order U.S. subs to launch against the USSR. I agreed with that and asked, so who was it? He replied, look, this could be one of those apocryphal Cold War stories that submariners or communication personnel make up to impress their girlfriends or their bar friends. Right, I agreed. That story is worth a big hug or a free beer. But it could also be true. Could be. So, I said, apparently we have the ELF transmitter count wrong. I'm counting 4 now. He stayed silent a while, then replied, actually, about 15 or 16 years ago, there was only one ELF station in the world. Ours, in Wisconsin. As I said, Michigan hadn't been built yet, and neither had Zev's. That's why I think this story has no basis. Who would build and operate an ELF transmitter with the purpose of starting a nuclear war? I thought maybe my crazy ex-father-in-law would do that, but he was too cheap to spend the bucks. So I suggested, the Chinese? You know, telling us to launch against the Ruskies, then sitting back and watching us destroy each other. Well, that's possible. But if they got caught at it, I wouldn't be surprised if the Russians and Americans agreed to nuke them for that. That is a very dangerous game to play. It was. And if you were a country with skin in the game, like China or Russia, you'd think twice about it. But if you were a rich, private, and crazy individual sitting in the mountains, you might want to amuse yourself with an ELF transmitter. I pointed out to Commander Nassif, you said these ELF waves could be monitored, so I assume the transmission source can also be located.
That is a good assumption. But the truth is no. Remember, the Earth itself has become the antenna, so the signals seem to emanate from all around you.
Like a cosmic message?
Well, it would be more like the ground shaking because of an earthquake. The signal would seem to be coming from everywhere.
So there's no way to trace the origin of an ELF signal?
Not in the sense that you're thinking of. But ELF receivers could get a general idea of where the transmission source was by comparing the effective radiated power that they were receiving at their site. Like all energy sources, the farther away from the origin you are, the weaker the signal becomes. That's how we learned about the Russian Zevs transmitter. We suspected that the Russians had an ELF transmitter to signal their submarines, so we put a receiving station in Greenland, and this station received strong signals. After a while, we were able to hone in on its general location in the Kola Peninsula, and spy satellites confirmed. But that was only because the Russians happened to be transmitting continuously while we hunted for the signal source.
I thought about that, then asked, was the Navy ever able to figure out where those bogus launch signals were coming from?
I have no idea, although I would suspect not, or everyone involved in naval communication would have heard about it, officially or unofficially. I never heard about it. He reminded me, but again, these bogus transmissions may never have occurred.
Well, I thought they had, and I suspected that Commander Nassif thought so too. I also thought I knew the source.
He switched to a happier thought. Well, thank God the Cold War is over.
You can say that again.
But he didn't.
Anything else? He asked.
I thought of Mikhail Putyov. Would a nuclear physicist be at all involved in extremely low-frequency technology?
Not at all. He'd probably know less about it than you do.
Hey, I'm an expert now. No one's gonna try to sell me an ELF wave oven.
Why, asked Commander Nassif, ignoring my joke, would ELF concern the Mideast section of the Anti-Terrorist Task Force?
Kate and I exchanged glances, and she wrote on my pad, you're the bullshitter.
Thanks, Kate.
I replied to Commander Nassif, well, as it turns out, based on what you've told us, we may be, well, on the wrong wavelength.
I chuckled for effect and explained, we're actually working on a case involving this environmental terrorist group called the Earth Liberation Front. ELF. Wrong ELF. Sorry.
Officer and gentleman that he was, Commander Nassif didn't dignify that bullshit with a response. Kate, who knows how not to ask a question that tips off the person being questioned, said to Nassif, John, I'm looking at my notes, and I think you said that the only suitable U.S. location for an ELF antenna and transmitter is this geological area in Wisconsin and Michigan called the Laurentian Shield. Do I have that right?
He could have been snotty and asked what that had to do with the Earth Liberation Front, but he answered, I think that's right.
Hold on. Here's another place in the U.S. where you can locate an ELF transmitter.
Neither Kate nor I asked where, but John Nassif informed us, you're actually standing on it.
Chapter 37. We sat on the enclosed porch, which was warmed by the sun coming in the big windows. Outside, leaves fell,
Ducks swam on the pond, and fat Canada geese waddled across the lawn without their passports. We were lost in our own thoughts, which were probably similar. Finally, Kate said, "Maddox has a big electrical generator and an ELF antenna on his property, and he probably has a transmitter somewhere in his lodge. Maybe his fallout shelter." I tried to lighten the moment. "So, you think Maddox is exploring for oil?" She wasn't in the mood for my humor and asked, "Do we think Maddox was the person who sent those ELF transmissions to the submarine fleet 15 years ago?"
"We do."
"But why?"
"Let me think. Hey, he was trying to start a thermonuclear war."
"Yes, I understand that. But why?"
"I guess he was just rolling the dice, crossing his fingers and hoping for a happy ending."
"That's insane."
"Right. But he didn't think so." I said to her, "You may be too young to remember, but there were people in this country in those days, Mr. Maddox, I'm sure, among them, who wanted to push the button first and get it over with. They truly believed that the Soviets would be caught napping, and that Soviet technology and weapon systems were faulty, and that we could survive whatever they threw back at us." I added, "Radioactive fallout is overrated."
"Totally insane."
"Well, fortunately, we'll never know." I thought a moment and said, "Maddox obviously had some inside information about military ELF codes and decided to use it. The technology to build the transmitter and antenna, as we heard, is not secret. And at some point, about 20 years ago, Maddox knew he needed the right piece of real estate. And before you know it, he's shopping for land in the Adirondack Mountains." I added, "Best investment he ever made." She nodded thoughtfully.
"I guess that's what happened. But it didn't work."
"No, thank God it didn't, or we wouldn't be here talking about it."
"Why didn't it work?"
I went over it in my mind and replied, "My guess is that he underestimated the sophistication and complexities of the computers and the software, which are obviously an integral part of the coded ELF transmissions. And at some point, he was warned by his inside guy that if he kept trying to get the launch code right, the government would make an all-out effort to discover the source of these bogus transmissions, and the FBI would be breaking down the door of the Custer Hill Club. So he gave up on his interesting hobby."
"Or maybe God intervened."
I gave that some consideration and said, "I have no doubt that Bain Maddox believed he was on God's side, and God was on his."
"Well, he wasn't."
"Apparently not. Meanwhile, what is the connection between ELF and Mikhail Putyov, former Soviet nuclear weapons physicist, currently a professor at MIT, and houseguest of Mr. Maddox?" Kate thought a moment, then replied,
Maybe this time Maddox is going to try to get our subs to launch against pre-designated targets in the Mideast, China or North Korea."
I processed that and said, "That sounds like the Bain Maddox we know. Interesting possibility. But it still doesn't explain Putyov." Kate thought about that and probably about things she never dreamed she'd be thinking about yesterday. She asked me, or herself,
"What the hell is this guy up to?"
"I think he's up to Plan B, and I have no idea what that is, except that it's a version of Plan A, which didn't work 15 years ago." I looked at my watch and stood. "Here's what I want you to do, Kate. Go online and see if there's anything else we need to know about ELF waves. Also, Google Mikhail Putyov, and while you're at it, Bain Maddox."
"Okay."
"And this is important. Get the laptop back to Wilma before 6:30. She forced a smile and asked,
"Can I go on eBay?"
"No, you may not go on eBay." "Okay, then call the FAA and get the continuing flight plans from Maddox's two jets. The tail numbers of his aircraft are in your briefcase.
That may take a while, knowing the federal bureaucracy as I do, but be persistent and charming.
Why do you think that's important?
I really don't know. But I'd like to know where Maddox sent those aircraft in case it becomes important. I added, also I'd like you to study those flight manifests, airline reservations, and car rental agreements, and see what else you can come up with. And call Putyoff's home and office and see if anyone knows his whereabouts.
Okay, but what are you doing while I'm doing all of this?
It's my nap time.
Very funny.
Actually, I'm gonna run a few errands. I'll get us some food plus some personal items, which don't seem to be included for $75, and whatever else you'd like.
She informed me, we don't need anything at the store, John. After we gather all this information, we are heading back to the city.
She added, I'll book a flight from Adirondack Regional Airport or someplace else around here. Kate, I don't think we have enough information yet to buy a get-out-of-jail-free card.
I think we do.
No, I think there are people in Washington who know at least as much as we do right now.
Then why did they send Harry to do surveillance on the Custer Hill Club?
Good question. And several answers came to mind. Well, maybe it had to do with this weekend gathering. But beyond that, I don't know.
John, I think Harry accomplished his assignment. I think they wanted him to get caught.
So did I. And now, so did Kate. I said, seems that way.
But why would they want him to get caught?
That's the big question. A possible answer is to signal to Bane Maddox that he is under the eye. They certainly didn't expect Maddox to murder the surveillance person he'd caught.
Why would the Justice Department and the FBI want Maddox to know he was under surveillance?
Sometimes, in police work, you use surveillance to shake up a suspect. Sometimes, with rich and powerful people, you use it as a courtesy or a warning. You know, like, cease and desist before you put us all in a bad situation.
Kate stood and came closer to me. She said, it could have been you.
Actually, I hope I would have had the brains to scrub the assignment as soon as I got a close look at the situation. Harry, on the other hand, was a simple soul who always put too much trust in the bosses and who followed orders. She asked me,
if you're right, do you think this surveillance has frightened Maddox into abandoning whatever he's up to?
I think a man like Maddox doesn't frighten very easily. He's a man with a mission, and he's already committed at least one murder on his way to completing that mission.
One that we know of.
Right. And I'm fairly sure that what happened this weekend had the opposite effect of what Washington hoped for. In fact, Bane Maddox's timeline has been shortened to about 24 hours, give or take a few hours.
It may just be that he knows the game is up and he's planning to flee the country. That's what most people would do.
I'm really convinced he's not like most people. But check out where his jets are. She nodded and said,
okay, but if you really think he's going ahead with whatever he's planned, and if you don't want to go back to the city, then we need to get to the closest federal attorney and ask for a search warrant for the Custer Hill Club.
Sweetheart, I think the only warrant you're going to find at a federal courthouse is an arrest warrant for Kate Mayfield and John Corey.
Then let's go to Schaefer and see if he can get the local DA to get a search warrant.
Kate, no one is going to issue any warrant with Bane Maddox's name on it based on what you or I tell them. We need to get more evidence.
Such as?
Well, obviously some hair and fibers from the Custer Hill Lodge that will match what was found on Harry's body and clothes. That's the connecting forensic evidence that's required to link Maddox's lodge to Harry and Harry to Maddox, who was at the lodge.
All right. But how do you get fibers from the Custer Hill Club without a search warrant?
the same way I'd do it if I was investigating the murder of John Doe, who I believed was last seen alive at the house of Joe Smith.
What do you mean?
I'm going to the Custer Hill Club to pay a visit to Mr. Maddox.
I don't want you to go there.
Why not? This is what I'd do at this stage of any other homicide investigation. We're running out of clues and leads at this point, so I need to go back to the prime suspect and talk to him.
I'm going with you.
Actually, you're not. I need you here to work the details that we'll need to build the case. The stuff we'll need to get a search warrant. Actually, the time was running out for that, but it sounded good.
No, she said firmly. You are not going there alone.
She looked at me.
It could be dangerous.
It's not dangerous. This is not Dracula's castle. I'm a federal agent making some inquiries.
He's already killed one federal agent.
Good point. But I replied, and he probably regrets it. If he doesn't, he will later. I walked back into the sitting area and put on my leather jacket. Kate followed and also put on her jacket. This was one of those moments that called for just the right combination of firmness and tenderness. I took her in my arms and said, I need you here. We're a little short on manpower today. I can really handle this myself.
No.
I think I have a better chance of getting in to see him if I'm alone.
No.
I'll check in with Schaefer's surveillance team at the intersection. Okay? I'll tell them to give me an hour, and if I'm not out by then, they should send in the cavalry. Okay? That seemed to do the trick, and she appeared less insistent that she go with me. I concluded with, keep in touch with Schaefer. Also, call the point and see who's looking for us. Tell them we're shopping in Lake Placid, and if Mr. Griffith calls, he should meet us downtown. And remind Jim that Sonny DeMott was going to loan me a tie and jacket for dinner.
He was?
I'm sure he would. Just bullshit them. I added, pretend you're me. She smiled, then said,
I want you to turn on your cell phone.
Kate, no cell phones. You turn that thing on, and Liam Griffith will be at this door within an hour.
John, this is not the way we work.
Now and then, sweetheart, you have to stretch the rules a little.
Now and then? You did this on the last case.
I did. Well, it turned out okay. Meanwhile, see if you can get a pizza delivered. We went to the door, and Kate said,
be careful.
No anchovies. We smooched, and off I went to Dracula's castle. Chapter 38. I found a convenience store on the outskirts of Canton. Or maybe it was downtown Canton. Hard to tell. Anyway, I went in and bought what I needed for my mission, which was a package of Drake's ring-dings with cream inside and one of those little sticky lint rollers. The checkout guy gave me a shortcut back to Colton, a distance of about 30 miles. I also asked him where the sporting goods store was, and he gave me directions. I got back in the car and thought about my next move. It was a little after 1 p.m., which meant I should be at the Custer Hill Gatehouse before 2 if I didn't stop to pick up a box of 9mm rounds and a few extra magazines. I mean, if I was going to blow Maddox's brains out, I had more than enough ammo in my 15-round magazine, plus one in the chamber. On the other hand, if I needed to shoot my way out of there, I was possibly a few rounds short. Bottom line with ammunition is that it's always better to have more than you need, because if you have less than you need, things didn't usually work out well. Also, I probably shouldn't have done an ammo check with Kate, who may have been wondering if I was planning an assault on the Custer Hill Club. I wasn't sure about that myself, but it was an option. Anyway, I decided that my first order of business should be to get to the Custer Hill Club and see what, if anything, Maddox was up to. If I needed more ammo, I knew Maddox had plenty of guns lying around. I began driving, and I turned on the radio and listened to a talk show in French, live from Quebec. I had no idea what they were saying, but everyone seemed really worked up about something, and I could pick out the words Iraq, America, Bush, and Hussein. The melodious French language was giving me a headache, so I scanned the channels, trying to find a news channel that might mention the hunting accident. But all I got were DJs and local commercials. I locked into a country western station, and Hank Williams was wailing, "You're cheating hard." Why I like this music is a mystery to me, and a secret I don't share with many people. The weather was still good, and the country road was decent and lightly traveled, so I was making good time. I opened the ring-dings and sharked the first one, then savored the second. Truly an exploration of chocolate. I noodled while I drove and listened to Hank singing, "Hey, good looking." First, Kate was safe enough back in Wilma's B&B if she didn't get an attack of duty, honor, and country, and call Walsh or Griffith. Ms. Mayfield is a bit more savvy than she seems, and I hoped that she was in her post-9/11 mindset and understood that something very odd was going on in New York and Washington, and that she shouldn't be calling anyone about that. Second, the last time I checked with Major Schaefer, he was on our side, but that could change very quickly. Or maybe he never really was on our side. If a state trooper pulled me over in my Enterprise rental car, I'd have the answer to that before I got to the Custer Hill Club. Third, Tom Walsh. He really wasn't clued in to whatever was going on, and now he was probably in trouble for sending the absolutely most wrong agents up here to work the case of the missing Harry Muller. Well, if he was in deep shit, he got what he deserved. On the other hand, he'd originally wanted me here in place of Harry. What was that all about? Fourth, Liam Griffith, the enforcer. I recalled that he was a friend of my enemy, the happily departed Ted Nash, CIA officer. So, as the Arabs would say, any friend of my enemy is my enemy, especially if they're both assholes. I needed to avoid this guy until I had the power to take him down. And last but not least, Mr. Bain Maddox, who had apparently once tried to start a thermonuclear war to see how it turned out. I mean, this was so far off the chart that I had trouble grasping it. But all the little pieces that I'd seen for myself, including meeting the gentleman, seemed to point in that direction. I thought maybe Maddox had watched too many James Bond movies during his formative years and related too well to the sicko villains. Bain Maddox, however, was not some movie bad guy with a foreign accent. He was an all-American boy, a war hero, and a success story. Sort of like Horatio Alger with a thermonuclear death wish. But as my therapist would say, if I had one, "John, the thermonuclear war thing is in the past, and we need to move on." Right. The problem now was to figure out what Bain was doing in that big house to turn his past failure into success. I got off the back road at Colton, headed south on 56, and entered the sleepy hamlet of South Colton. And there was Ratso Rudy chewing the fat with some guy in a pickup truck. I couldn't resist, so I pulled into the station. "Hey, Rudy." He saw me and ambled over to the car. I said, "I'm lost again." "Yeah? Hey, how you doing?" He observed, "You got a new car." "No, this is the same one." "You sure? You had a Taurus yesterday."
"I did."
"Hey, did you see Mr. Maddox last night?" Well, yeah, I wanted to talk to you about that. He didn't want to see me.
He told me he did.
You sure?
That's what he said.
I added, sorry about telling him you said I should get the money up front. Yeah, I tried to explain that to him, but he thought that was funny for some reason.
Yeah?
What else did he say?
Well, he said you was pulling my leg. He said you was a wise guy and a troublemaker.
Me?
Is that the thanks I get for fixing his ice maker?
He said there was nothing wrong with his ice maker.
Who are you gonna believe? Me or him?